Hey everyone, welcome to this week's show. This is Lisa Anderson. Let me give you a little preview of what is coming up. Our friend Joshua Rogers is back to answer our inbox from someone who describes himself as a relationship virgin. And I have definitely talked to y'all out here who fit this camp, the people who are like, I can't even remember the last time I was on a date, or I have never been on a date, or I don't even remember what it's like to be in a relationship. So he's going to offer some wisdom there. And then for our culture segment, we have the fabulous Glenn Stanton, researcher here, to talk about why your risk for divorce is probably a lot lower than you think. In fact, he is going to argue that for some people, it is almost zero. Do you believe him? Wait and see. You got to hear that segment. For our roundtable, though, speaking of similar topics, we're going to talk about cohabitation. So, and not in like a really weirdo, wonky way. We're just talking to normal people here. We have Jake, Brandon, and Ashley. Hey, guys.
Hey. Hello.
What is the weirdo, wonky way?
Well, you know, where people just pull out like graphs and charts and go into like U.S. Census Bureau stuff. I know.
I'm going to hide the
Brandon's
going
to bring that
in front
to the
of
table.
My face.
Brandon has his pivot tables and whatever else available
right.
to him. So.
Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, exactly. But we thought of this because, I mean, not that we haven't talked about this subject before, but because there is a Barna study out that talks about cohabitation with the U.S. populace, specifically the millennial generation. Speaking of the U.S. specifically, two-thirds of adults in America are okay with cohabitation. Obviously, the number is smaller when you talk to Christians, self-identified Christians, but the rate of cohabitation among Christians is rising as well. And most Christian young adults can't even really define or describe why they think cohabitation is wrong, if in fact they do. Many of them, in fact, the majority, say that they disagree with it because of, quote, religious reasons, which what what in the world? My religion precludes me from doing that. And then people will be like, will you tell me where in the Bible it says? And then they're just stuck. So, but for those who believe that cohabitation is a good thing, not surprisingly, the number one reason 84% of people think that it's to test compatibility. So got to test drive that car, people.
It's a data-driven approach, right? Yeah. I need to see the data. I need to run some tests as we share toothbrush jars.
Yes. Now, for those opposed to it, I mentioned religious reasons, but following close on that reason's heels is just generally a disagreement with having sex before getting married. So kind of those two lumped together make for over 60% actually of respondents. So I want to dive right in with y'all. Because Jake, you're married.
See, yes, I am.
Brandon and Ashley both engaged.
Correct.
So having to, and in fact, I do want to, first of all, congrats.
Oh, thank you.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
So,
yeah.
Three lottery
winners. It was not long ago that we were asking Brandon, even right. in light of this own show. So when is this happening? Because we have timelines that we have to talk about here. So when
so,
we,
it did.
When
it
we
did
can
happen.
Mention it. So yeah. Yay. Congratulations
you.
To you.
Exciting.
Very exciting. And so, obviously, this is a, like, top of mind living it. In fact, I want to tell everyone that tomorrow on the blog, Ashley is featured with a post talking about this. So, really, with your reasons, why you and your fiancé have chosen not to live together before marriage. So, really, really great piece. But, okay, so let's jump in here. What, first of all, now, recent past, you know, long ago past, whatever, what generally, ear to the ground, have you all heard? Both from non-Christian friends, from Christian friends, like, where would you describe in your peer group this conversation is happening right now? What does it look like?
I mean, from the standpoint of those that don't cite biblical reasons, I mean, it's exactly that. It's testing compatibility. It's this sense of risk aversion. Like, I want to see all the cards on the table before I, you know, commit to this long term. Mm-hmm. And then from the biblical moral side, it's kind of like, well, the Bible says no fornication, so there.
Mm-hmm. So they kind of put it in that, Kim. Okay.
Yeah.
For the people that I know that are not Christians, I feel like it's just sort of another step, like you date before you get engaged, but you also to them, you live together before you get married. It's just like not really something they even think about.
Okay.
Like for instance, my fiance, his coworkers, most of them are all dating and they all live together. Mm-hmm. So like at the work Christmas party this last year, they're all like, oh, you guys don't live together? What? That's so weird. Because they all do.
Yeah.
And it's like,
well, and to be engaged and not living together,
right,
they're probably like,
exactly,
what in the world?
Yeah. So it's just like a totally different mindset that they don't even think about it. It's not, I don't know, not something that they have to decide.
Yeah. It does seem that it's one of those kind of next step kind of things that people assume, oh, it's just the progression of our relationship. Mm-hmm. It's kind of, you know, some people are like, oh, it's our big next step. And some people are like, no, it's just assumed. That's just where we go with it. So, yeah.
Well, I think it can, I don't know, some of the friends I have too, are they don't even really believe in marriage anymore. You know, it's like, well, what's the, I don't need to get married. I can just live with them and get the benefits of that without everything else. You know, why introduce the complexity of a marriage when you can just, you know, we're doing fine. So we'll just live together.
Yeah.
And that's,
well, it's almost like, I think of this as I read, you know, one of my sources of news, People Magazine, and you look at like celebrity relationships and you're like, oh my word, are they still engaged? Like people who have been engaged for like 8-9 years, like celebrity couples, and you're like, at this point, I've stopped waiting to hear any kind of announcement of a wedding, or else they'll maybe jet off to some island and get married and no one ever knows about it because you just assumed like, oh, well, okay, they acted like they were married anyway. So it is really weird. And I think we're kind of translating that kind of mindset into normal people, quote unquote, and the world at large is doing it. But what about, okay, what about Christians specifically, like within the church, your friends, do any of you talk about this? Is it just assumed among your peer groups, you know, in Christian circles that, oh no, we would never do that? Or do some people wrestle with it, would you say?
I thought it was assumed until, I don't know, maybe 5-6-ish years ago when, like, I started seeing, you know, family members or friends that started doing it, started moving in together, and it was people that, you know, you assumed agreed with you on this topic, and all of a sudden it was like, it's not that big of a deal. Mm-hmm. We know where this is going, so it's fine.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. Kind of convenience, almost.
Right. And, like, you know, this rejection of, what's the difference between doing it now versus after we have a piece of paper signed?
Uh-huh.
Like, we're heading towards that piece of paper being signed anyways, so that's just a formality.
Yeah. Hmm. Okay. You know, it's interesting because I, when I've traveled, especially overseas, in fact, I've been in Asia a couple times in the last couple of years, and they cite just the cost of living as one of their reasons. You know, I mean, you're trying to get an apartment in Hong Kong or Singapore or something, and they're like, oh no, well, we have to do it. It'd be ridiculous. We couldn't each do this on our own, or we couldn't, you know, or the government doesn't even allow us to get our own place unless, so I think there's a lot, they get squishier in their lines there.
Yeah,
yeah, I'm
well,
talking to you, Asian friends.
Well, no, but I think that's a good point, because there are a lot of these practical things, like as we've gotten the state more involved in the marriage proceedings, like from a Christian perspective, you know, for example, I've got a brother who's about to be engaged, you know, he's bought a ring and, you know, they've talked about marriage, but his girlfriend is from Switzerland and he's not from Switzerland.
Mm-hmm.
And so now they have all these practical considerations of, hey, we want to meet family and we want to do this and that. And the other thing, we want to do this whole, the wedding right and do this legally. But now they're talking about immigration and which visas do they need to get? And if they do it this with this visa, they could get charged for fraud by getting married. And so, I mean, there are a lot of these practical situations, you know, even that people have to consider and say, okay, what is the line now between a marriage in the eyes of God and a marriage in the eyes of the state?
Yeah.
And that's not necessarily new, but I think it has new implications on us now as they've gotten more and more entwined in our understanding.
Okay. Hmm. So, Jake, as someone who has been married for how long now?
We are coming up on 9 years.
Wow. All right. Okay. So someone who has some marriage under their belt, what would you say? Because I hear a lot of people that say, you know, well, I need to know what I'm getting into. I've got to, you know, I've got to have all my facts straight. I need to know that this person isn't crazy, you know, whatever. I've always made the argument that you're never really going to know everything you need to know about a person before you get married. So what would you, from experience, speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, there's so many things that just come out in a different kind of pressure cooker, and marriage is different. Like, when we look at these numbers and we look at numbers like actually Glenn Stanton, our very own Glenn Stanton, and all his research is and even Greg and Aaron Smalley, when they talk about how long it takes in a marriage for people to go from being individuals to being a couple, mm-hmm. you're talking about a decade. Mm-hmm. And so that's a lot of time where you're figuring each other out, where you're finding out these new things. I mean, I think I've talked on a previous episode about my own wife and her love languages. The fact that they've changed since we got married. Her primary love language today is different than it was in our first 2 years of marriage. And so it's like there's all these things that you're never going to know for sure. Okay. And so you've always got to, I think, approach your marriage or any kind of relationship as it's just you're figuring it out. I like how they say it in the movie Fireproof. It's cheesy, but you got to become, get your bachelor's degree, and then you got to get your next degree, because I can't remember what it's called, and then your doctorate.
Like, your master's.
Yeah, you're always trying to get to know your spouse better. And so if you're waiting until you know your significant other really, really well before you get married, mm-hmm. you're never going to get married.
Yeah, okay. So Brandon and Ashley, so, mm-hmm. Through dating and now engagement, mm-hmm. what did this conversation, did you have to have this conversation, or did you just kind of slide into it, or what, where did this come about for y'all?
Mm-hmm. Well, like I mentioned, people asked us, oh, are you guys living together? I mean, right from when I first started dating him, people started, like my dentist, which I kind of talked about that a little bit more in the blog, but yeah, asked me right away, like, are you guys living together? And it just really surprised me because it was just the assumption. So we definitely talked about it more.
What a weird question. I don't know. Why that would be your first thing.
Who says that? Yeah.
Was your dentist single and just
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Like, break this thing off. How big is the rock? I don't know. Is this going to go anywhere?
I don't know. And it's always so awkward. You're like trying not to drool everywhere and there's stuff in your mouth. Yeah. Anyways, so we kind of talked about it in more of like a, just like a joking manner, like, oh, I can't believe everyone thinks that we're like, why is everyone assuming this? That's not like a Christian or the people that didn't know us, mm-hmm. So we talked about it in that way a little bit, but I think it was already just kind of assumed that we would never do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think more of an assumption, but we did talk about it, trying mm-hmm. to set those boundaries and mm-hmm. say that we want to honor the Lord. And we've both been in past relationships where we didn't kind of follow some of those things. And it was very important to both of us that while it's hard and it's not easy, I would always tell her, that we're never going to regret not doing this. We'll regret if we compromise on something, mm-hmm. That's when it's going to come up. So I made it a point to make sure we were on the same page.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting how, Jake referenced our friend Glenn Stanton, how he's brought out research before that shows that even if you take faith out of it completely, sociologically, there are no indicators that show that living together is of any benefit. And in fact, it's quite a detriment. They say that cohabiting couples have higher risks of domestic abuse within the home, higher risk of divorce if you actually eventually do make it to the altar, having lived together, your chances of divorce are a lot higher. Just the inequitability, is that a word?
Yep.
the way that even labor within the home is inequitable. I mean, sorry guys, but guys who have a ring on it are just more committed and more willing to pitch in than, cohabiting dudes. So they just feel kind of free and free as a bird, I guess. So Brandon, you have that to look forward to.
Oh, yes.
So get the awesome. The work gloves
power,
on,
right,
and the
yeah, comes great responsibility.
There you go.
Exactly. So so that would definitely be one thing as well. And then the one that I always like to highlight when I'm out speaking is the idea that once you are cohabiting, it is much more difficult to get out of a bad relationship because mm-hmm. by the time you've entwined yourself into all these things, maybe you're sharing rent or you're sharing a mortgage. Some people start sharing pets. I mean, and then eventually, people even share children. And then it's like, well, he's really a loser, but we have this dog. And so I don't really know what to do, and I'm like, oh, my word. And so people, their lives are stalling out as a result of that. So it does. I mean, I think it makes a big difference. But I have been surprised, too, because I have, whether among my own friends or as I've talked to others who I'll just say generally like a couple pastors I knew and really respected and their kids chose to live with their boyfriends or girlfriends before marriage. And I know it just devastated the pastor because they're just like, why in the world would anyone do it? I mean, their generation is so, mm-hmm. in fact, I think it's the Busters, the Greatest Generation. I think they're only like 30% or less that would even consider living together an okay thing, you know, of that older grandparents' generation. So there's definitely been a shift in that. What do you guys see as far as the responsibility of the church or a community of believers to do this? Because, I mean, do you ever sit in your small group and just be like, who's living together with anyone because we need to call you out? I mean, it's kind of awkward, but biblical, probably.
Yeah, I mean, at that point, it's not that you'll never convince people that are already in that situation to back away from it. There's a case to be made that you can still reach them there. But I think the problem is reaching them before that. Because I think, like Ashley was saying, it's just this preconceived notion. It's okay. We see it, you know, we talk about how often we see it in pop culture, and it becomes this self-reflecting cycle where the culture reflects it to us and we reflect it back to the culture. So it becomes this normal thing. Mm-hmm. It's like the new engagement ring is the key to your house, like to say we should live together. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've seen that in several of shows that I really like where they're building to, is he ever going to ask me to move in with him? Mm-hmm. And so there's this preconceived notion that I think we've got to get at. But I think the problem of the church is that by and large, and we do this in other areas, we talk so much more about what we're against rather than what we're for. Mm-hmm. And we don't do a good job telling the story of why we're for. Because like you said, the weirdo way is to just pie charts and graphs and numbers. Mm-hmm. But Jesus taught in parables for a reason. Mm-hmm. Because he wanted there to be a pebble that stuck in people's shoe and force them to think about things themselves and to get deeper themselves. Mm-hmm. And so we've got to take these numbers. We've got to say, instead of just saying, hey, you know, you're 4 to 8 times more likely to be unfaithful to your significant other if you've cohabitated. Like, well, everybody can say, well, I'm going to be the stat, you know, I'm going to be the non-stat in that situation. But what if we start to tell a different story? What if we start to put it in human terms? What if we start to correlate it to what people know and experience and give those types of examples at a younger age instead of just saying, well, the Bible says so, so there it is.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it, too, is asking the right questions to those people, like the ones that are either considering living together or maybe already are. Because I think a lot of people cohabitate out of fear because they're afraid either of commitment or afraid that the person isn't going to really be who they say they are, or there's just, you know, a million things that you could be afraid of. So maybe even asking questions in regard to that, like, are you afraid of commitment, or why not just get married? You know, like, talking on a deeper level about some of the root issues behind the decision. And a lot of people do it because they've seen their own parents' marriage fail. They've seen divorce in their grandparents or their parents or whatever it is. And so maybe talking about some of those issues behind the issue, I think, is a good place to start for the church.
Yeah, it's interesting. I also want to, just as we close out here, one question I always get when I'm out and about is, well, what about we're not in a romantic relationship? We're just, you know, a bunch of friends and we happen to be just co-ed. We just want to share a house. We just want to be. And everyone thinks that it's going to turn out like Friends and it's going to be super cool. And there's always going to be the fun, quirky people and the, you know, someone's going to have a guitar.
It's going to turn out like Friends and you all are going to start sleeping
with
each other. I was going to say, they all slept with each other pretty much.
Yeah, friends without benefits, maybe they're assuming. I don't know, but yeah. Wishful thinking. But I always say, you know, there are some things that are illegal, some are immoral, and some are just stupid. And even if you never got into that, if you're like, well, none of us are attracted to each other, one, someone always will be. Something's always going to happen. Like, again, Friends example. Mm-hmm. But two, there's just an intimacy to living in the same space and sitting around in the morning in your pajamas, eating Cheerios or whatever. It's just weird. Okay. And we've talked about that before, Boundless and stuff. And so I just bring that up as a suggestion of something to think about, because there are many other ways to go about this. I mean, there are many other places you could live, you know, make it happen. Flee from temptation. Be a great example to both Christian brothers and sisters and non, a lot of different factors in that. But again, it's great when we get research like this and when we see kind of where it is, get a temperature in the culture, because I think that helps us be able to address it. Hopefully, as Ashley said, sooner rather than later. So we're not like, oh my goodness, you know, here I'm in this relationship. What do I do? Think about it ahead of time, but. Thanks, you guys.
Yeah, thank you. Love it.
All right. It's the love of a father, the strength of a king. It's the blood of a savior. You're my everything. folks, here we are for our culture segment, and we get to welcome back Glenn Stanton, one of our own here at Focus on the Family. Hey, Glenn.
Hey, how are you? I like being in the culture section, being a very cultured person.
You are very cultural, so that's good. I hate using your title because it's Director of Family Formation Studies, which no one even understands.
Right.
So I like to say you're a marriage and family researcher for us, kind of keeping an ear to the ground. What's going on, and hopefully disseminating some truth around facts and figures.
Ear to the ground and finger in the air, just so that I can see which way the winds are blowing.
That's
but no,
good.
You're exactly right.
Yeah. No, it is. It's a good thing. Well, and you're a Bob Dylan fan, so speaking of blowing wind.
That is the
wasn't
most
that a great reference?
Thing.
Oh, my goodness. I
that
just surprised
was
myself.
Very good.
I
that
totally
was
shocked
very
myself.
Good, but...
Oh, you know, but none of our audience will get it.
But blowing in the wind, that's pretty low-hanging fruit.
Well,
for... Right.
Just throw me a bone, okay?
Yeah, okay.
I mean,
but
I
no, that was good. That was impressive.
Thanks.
Especially coming from a Bill Gaither fan.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure he has songs about wind.
Do you know that Bob and Bill used to hang back
no.
in the day?
Mm-mm.
Yeah, I don't
Are
know.
Are you just making that up?
Yeah, I'm making it up. But it would be cool, though.
It would Could be cool.
Could you imagine them on a road trip together?
I know, a tour.
Yeah.
I think maybe it would be fun. So that, of course, leads us into the natural segue of divorce. towards divorce. Sorry that you get to be our divorce expert all the time.
No, that's so. Fine. I'm probably more than you could imagine just
in this realm.
Yeah.
Well, I think this is good. We wanted to have you on the show because you actually, and you've mentioned this in the past, because I know you're pretty passionate about having correct statistics when it comes to various cultural trends and especially where the family's going and stuff.
We're born again, not born yesterday, so we need to get our stuff right.
Exactly. That's good. So you're basically, first of all, I want to talk about any time that largely in evangelical circles, I read statistics around divorce, usually people will say, okay, the divorce rate is about 50% and it's hardly any different for Christian couples than it is for the general market, for the population at large. You are saying, you actually take issue with that and you're saying that those stats are not correct. Where did that statistic come from and how long has it been around?
Yeah, what first of all about? Is the divorce rate is just as high in the church as it is in the world. Now, that is as often stated as it is just flat wrong.
Wow.
And it came from some different sources. There was a Christian researcher that I won't mention names, but what he found out was that the divorce rate is significantly high in the South part of the United States, the Bible Belt.
Mm-hmm.
Ergo,
mm-hmm.
divorce rate is high among the church. But what sociologists know is that's not really the case. We could say instead that the divorce rate is high in the mobile home belt. In the sense of you have large population of lower income, lower education, got married very early, and that's why you have a greater divorce rate. It's a very simplistic kind of assumption that it's just terribly irresponsible to say that, okay, because it's in the Bible Belt, it must be the Christians. I mean, researchers who state this kind of stuff need to know better. But it took huge traction within the church. And one important thing there is, I mean, not surprisingly, if you just look at people who just call themselves Christians, me and my family, we've always been Presbyterian, no change in marriage or divorce rates there. But for people who take their faith seriously and imperfectly, I mean, just people who are like, you know what, I belong to Christ, I'm trying to follow him the best I can, and I go to church more times a month than I don't, those people have much lower divorce rates than the general population. And that's shown time and time and time again in the literature. Now, the other kind of myth is the 50% divorce rate. In one sense, that's very, very true. Absolutely right. And there have been a number of Christian authors, even lately in the last couple of years, who have said, no, the 50% divorce rate, absolute myth. It's never been anywhere near that. And that's not true. The 50% number is not a hard, specific number. It's not a particular measure. What it is it's a very sophisticated way of looking at future risk of divorce. Let me explain that. The citation should be, couples marrying today have about, in general, a 50% likelihood of divorce before their 20th year of marriage. So it's a projection, just like the insurance guys could tell us, okay, Glenn, you don't run, you eat fatty foods, you never, get any exercise, things like that. You're expected to die at about age 58. That's what that divorce figure is a projection. Now, the real number, it's close to 50%, but it's anywhere between 40 and 50%, and some targeted about 44, 45%, which is the number that I use. So it means generally, people marrying today for the first time have about a 44 to 45% likelihood of their marriage ending in divorce by about year 20. But, Lisa, here's the big, big news. That number, 44 to 45%, applies to nobody. Hmm. And that's what's important to talk about today.
Yeah. Okay, so for the person who is like, this is super wonky, these are all statistics, why are we talking about divorce? Like on the show a lot, we have talked about the fact that many millennials specifically are delaying marriage because there's this certain fear around marriage that they can't do it well or they can't go the distance or whatever, largely because their parents' generation, the boomers, kind of are known for not doing it well, largest divorce generation in history. Where did those statistics come into play? Like, why were the boomers so more than any other generation kind of messed up? What happened?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Because what I want to do is I want you to go into why there is hope. Please hang in with us, folks, because we're going to talk about why there is hope for those of you that are hopeful for marriage and you don't have to, approach it with
And there's great hope. There's great news. But to your question, very important. First of all, even from the colonial days, the United States has always led the world in divorce rates. Hmm. Divorce rates have always been relatively higher in the United States than anywhere else in the world. But to your question, why is it that the boomers had a higher rate of divorce than any other previous generation? One of the reasons has to do with a sociological truism, and that is that generations are shaped by the generation that came before them. Mm-hmm. This generation today, like you just said, is remarkably pro-marriage, even though they're scared to death of it. Mm-hmm. They are remarkably pro-marriage because their boomer parents did such a poor job. And this younger generation is not saying, you know what, I'm so excited to be able to have the opportunity to divorce just like my parents did. They want something different. Now, look at the boomers. They came out of the relative social and familial security of the 40s and 50s. They saw their dad go to the office, work hard. They saw mom be faithful to dad, dad be faithful to mom. And they grew up in the 60s and kind of rebelled against that or just said, you know what, I'm not going to live my life in this quote unquote dutiful way. You know what, maybe freedom in relationships, freedom in sexuality is not such a bad idea. So that generation was essentially the free love generation, the we should be able to enter and exit relationships as we want to be able to become better people. And so that was that boomer generation. And now their kids are growing up saying, you know what my number one wish in life is to find a mate and to marry for life and to have a happy relationship and to raise our kids together. Yeah. So again, we see that in that one generation shapes the other, and typically that subsequent generation is a reaction for good or for bad to what they were raised in. And that's exactly what we're seeing here.
Yeah. So you actually, to this point, wrote an article, "Your risk of divorce is likely much lower than you've been led to believe," which kind of lays it out there.
Yeah.
And in that, you actually say that there are many people who are marrying today that actually have a nearly zero risk of divorce.
Mm-hmm.
How
mm-hmm.
can that actually be? Who are these people? Am I one of them?
It's done through
mirrors.
You know
what? Your risk is very low if you don't get married.
You know what?
I was going to say.
That shows up time and time again in the research.
Yeah.
Now, and if you marry at like age 69, mm-hmm. your risk of divorce is just nearly gone. Right. So you're just a few years from
And
only in my relationship, my friendship with Lisa, could
Glenn's
I have even
last
gone
last appearance
there.
On the Boundless Show. We appreciate you, Glenn. Thank you.
Okay. No. The important thing there is, yes, let's go back. The 45% divorce risk number is true, but that applies to nearly nobody because of this fact. We all have different life choices that we've made that either elevate or lower our risk of divorce. Let's start with the first biggest one, and that's cohabitation. People who have cohabited before marriage have anywhere from a 50 to 80% greater likelihood of facing divorce once they do marry. And so if you are going to the altar to get married and you haven't cohabited with anybody prior to marriage, your rate of risk went way down. Okay, another thing is if you have your first child after you get married, rate of divorce goes way down. Now, you need to understand there's lots of people out there who have done exactly the opposite. They've had their first child before they get married. So they're skewing those numbers significantly high. So lack of cohabitation, lack of you know, avoiding having your first baby before you're married, marrying at a little bit older age, anywhere from 22 to 24, 25, that reduces your risk of divorce significantly as opposed to, you know, marrying younger. The other is couples who are married where either one of them has a little bit of college under their belt, you know, before they marry, mm-hmm. that reduces your risk of divorce as well. Hmm. Being sexually involved before marriage, those who come to the altar virgins, or you know what, you had a slip up one time, two times, they are significantly less likely to divorce, substantially less likely. So you've got all these factors mm-hmm. that are really many ways in favor of good Christian kids that do reduce your risk of divorce dramatically, almost to nearly nil.
Yeah. I see that there are a couple on the list, lifestyle choice things as well in there. Like, for example, the choice to do premarital counseling.
Yep.
People that do that go in, you know, obviously not going in blind, not a Vegas wedding because you had a crazy weekend or something like that. So approaching it intentionally. Would be
Premarital counseling. I mean, the research shows us that that reduces your risk of divorce by about 30% because that process, it's preparing you for it. But your premarital counselor will also help you be aware of some of the problems that might come up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very significant. You know, another is having common beliefs. You know what? We're both conservative, or we're both liberal. We're both Christians, but you could have, you know what? I'm Baptist and she's, you know, Pentecostal, and mm-hmm. you know that can create a little bit of problems. But if you have similar beliefs that you share, that helps significantly as well. One of them that I found very surprising was even smoking. Couples where one smokes and the other doesn't smoke, their risk of divorce is much higher. But couples where both smoke, their risk of divorce is high still. Couples who do not, that improves their chances of marital success.
Interesting. I want to circle back to age really quick. You talked about the 22 to 24, 26-year-old. What about moving into the 30s? Because I know a lot of young adults who marry a little bit later are like, oh, I don't know if this is going to work because I'm so stuck in my ways or what.
Yeah.
What exactly does stuck in your ways entail? And is it, I mean, is that a hurdle to overcome for them? Or
well, and that's a good question. It is a bit of a hurdle, but not much. I mean, the quote-unquote ideal age, if you will, for, you know, marriage is like from 22 to 25, 26 years of age based on maturity. But after that, your risk of divorce is not increased really, nor is the maturity that you've developed a benefit either. But it does mean that, you know, and I remember my wife and I, we got married early, and the thing of is, well, that's not the way I've always done it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're 30, 35, I mean, that always is a longer period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, just being aware of that, and in premarital counseling, your counselor can help you with that. Of, you know, there are things that you're going to have to be flexible with. And so that's more attitudinal than it is like, oh my goodness, I'm 30, I'm 35, I'm so set in my ways, I would be a disaster as a spouse.
Mm-hmm.
No, not at all. It just means flexibility and being able to work through particular issues.
Yeah. I think recognizing too, because the 30-something's going to be bringing in what we would traditionally term a little bit more baggage into the relationship, past decisions, probably past relationships, whatever,
yeah,
than that young 20-something. And so keep that in mind. So what, in light of that, Glenn, what would you say for single young adults who are listening? What is their best way? Like right now, like say they came from a divorced home, they're kind of like they haven't seen great examples. What could they be doing right now to most likely divorce-proof their future marriage?
Well, you know, first of all is decide not to move in with somebody, to be sexually chaste. And out of that, you know, not have your first child before you get married. But, you know, beside all of that, I think one of the best things that you can do, I think even after you're married is, I mean, I've lost count doing radio interviews over the years. I've lost count of young adults who tell me I have never known a successful marriage, not in my own family or around my friends. I mean, that's just unbelievable, but I hear it time and time again. So if that's your situation and, you know, a successful marriage is like a Bigfoot or UFO sighting for you, go find people in the community and in your churches that have been married 25, 30 years or more, and just say, you know what? Can I be friends with you? Can I study you? Can I observe you? Can I just at least get security and confidence that this can work? And some of the best people, couples that you can find like that, are the imperfect ones. You know, because many times, like at a church, you see this older couple and they're like, oh my goodness, you know, you shouldn't study us because, you know, in year 22, he had an affair, or I had an affair, or, you know, we even separated for a while. And you have to ask, well, are you married today? Yes. Well, that means you succeeded, you know. Please help me know. Please help me and my mate, my beloved, know and understand how to navigate these things. So just because your family hasn't seen success or your larger circle of influence hasn't seen success in marriage, go out there and find those people. And a lot of them show up at churches, and go to churches and find people like that, and don't apologize, glom onto them and just say, you know what, I'd love to observe how you guys do marriage so we can learn from you.
Yeah. I would say it almost stands to reason, too. You know, you mentioned kind of the three big ones, cohabitation and sexual activity. And then what was the third one?
Childbearing.
Yeah. Not having kids. I mean, on the front end of dating someone, figure out if the person you're dating also holds those values.
Yeah.
Because again, you're not going to want to spend your entire relationship convincing them why you shouldn't be cohabiting before you get married, you know? So
exactly.
Again, it comes down to character and shared values, and don't waste your time.
Yeah, and it comes down to shared values.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, making sure that you agree on these sorts of things. And nobody's going to agree on everything, but there are certain things that it is more important to agree on than not.
Right. Yeah. Great points, Glenn. Again, the full article, we have it linked there on the blog, so check it out. Pass it along, post it on social media, and let us know what you think. Thanks, Glenn.
Thank you, Lisa.
You're my beginning and you're my forever. You are my victory and my surrender. Oh, hallelujah, by your mercy I am new. This life is nothing without you. Oh, let your hope.
As we finish out the show, we are opening up our inbox, and I have Joshua Rogers back to answer our question. Hey, Joshua.
Hey, Lisa.
Thanks for being here. We have another one from a guy for you. And this guy definitely needs some encouragement, and so I'm going to ask you to weigh in on this. He says, I'm a 26-year-old male and have been single my entire life. I've always longed for love and companionship, but have never succeeded in finding it, even temporarily. I've always been shy, but even when I've mustered up the courage to pursue a relationship with a girl, I've always failed. My experiences have led me to question God's desires for me. I've been wondering if he wants me to feel as if I'm not good enough for a relationship or marriage, or if he wants me to be full of bitterness and depression, because these are all things I've been feeling for some time now. Of course, I don't believe my loving Lord and Savior wants this for me, so I'm quite confused. Any help or advice you could give would be greatly appreciated.
Well, Lisa, this one really breaks my heart.
Mm-hmm.
I almost get a lump in my throat about this one. I mean, this just, if I could say something to this guy, I mean, the most important thing I can start with is God loves you so much, and he cares about your deep desire for a relationship. There's nothing wrong with that. It's a good thing. And I know there are a lot of people who are struggling in a lot of areas, and they feel, you know, similar temptations to wonder, am I being punished or something? And that can be, you know, everything from I'm unemployed and I can't seem to get a job, or, I'm a married woman who can't get pregnant. I mean, there are a lot of ways that people are tempted towards this. Satan's first temptation in the garden was, is God really good, essentially? Is he really good? Or is he withholding something from you? And so you are actually hearing that temptation. It's becoming more attractive, but it's the oldest one in the books. And I think the most troubling thing about entertaining that is that, you buy into this idea and you forget that God is not a manipulator. He does not toy with the tender places in our hearts. And as you're tempted to make these assumptions, then I cannot help but believe there is some like demonic influence going on here. And that may sound extreme to people out there. That's fine. This is, again, the way Satan works. And so, the question is, how do you resist this lie and pursue a relationship at the same time? And I would say, first of all, I encourage you to be honest with God about your fear of him. You just need to tell him, God, I'm afraid you hate me. I'm afraid you don't care about me. I'm afraid you're going to just force me to be single. I'm afraid I'm going to become a bitter old man. And I would also encourage you, a good resource is Philip Yancey's book, What's So Amazing About Grace. Number two, you've got to get some counseling from a Christian counselor. That may sound extreme. I'm sure you've got very good reasons for not doing it. It's expensive. I don't have time. Whatever they are, there are deeper issues going on with you, man. And it is going to block your ability to connect with other people. I mean, think about this. If you think God, the one who loves you unconditionally, cannot be trusted, you're going to have trust issues with everybody else. And especially the kinds of relationships that could develop into romance, which require trust and vulnerability. And then the third thing I would say is you got to seek out some guy friends who are the kind of man you want to be. Even if they're significantly older than you, it may take a long time, but the things that make them attractive people will probably start to rub off on you as you unconsciously begin to emulate them and just kind of steep in their lives and see what they're really like, and then maybe take some tips from them. I just want to close by saying this. You know, I realize there are really deep wounds here, and a five-minute answer to your question isn't going to address them. But I can tell you this. I know you're in a hard place, and you're not going to get out on your own. If you were, you would have done it already. You have got to get the help of God, a counselor, and a community of believers to get to these underlying issues, and I don't know what they are. But the fact that the Boundless Show chose to answer your question is not an accident. You needed to hear this. You needed to know that God loves you. You need to know that He's the Father you may have never had. I don't know. He cares for you. He is watching you closely, and He is cheering as you begin to deal with these issues that are holding you back. He is on your side. He is here for you. He will see you through this. Do not give up on God. He is not going to give up on you. Take this journey with Him. Walk with Him. He wants to be with you. I encourage you to keep on doing that, and I'm proud of you for asking this hard question.
Hey, Joshua, thank you so much for that encouragement. Friend and listener, I also want to offer something on behalf of Focus on the Family, and that is a chat with one of our counselors. We have got a team of counselors here that are ready and waiting to answer calls, to call people back, and give advice after they hear out what your struggle is. So call 1-800, the letter A, and the word family, 1-800-A-FAMILY, and ask to be connected to one of our counselors. You can also go to focusonthefamily.com and access a counselor, shoot an email or access a counselor there. But calling is probably the quickest way to do that. So we want to get you help right away. And so as a springboard off of what Joshua said, let us do that to help you. All right, folks. Well, that is it for this week's show. We do want to hear from you. Do find us over at boundless.org and let us know what you think. If you need prayer, shoot us an email, say something on the blog. We would love to be in your space in this situation and beyond. So that is it for this week's show. I'm Lisa Anderson for The Boundless Show.
The Boundless Show is a production of boundless.org. Focus on the family.